This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Scotland Outdoors podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello, thanks very much for choosing to listen to this. I'm Mark Stephen. We build this Saturday edition of the Scotland Outdoors podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which this week I think contained possibly the finest example of the mystery bird we've ever done. And a very good morning to you. And it is a very, very good morning. I've got the fire on. The sun has just peeked across the ridge of the roof across there. And I'm standing with my eyes shut, just feeling the effects of the sun's rays. It's a lovely start to the morning. I'm Mark Stevens, standing here in the car park at Beechgrove. Standing 40 miles to the north, no doubt bedecked in tweeds and tartan, Mr. Ewan McElraith in the stately grounds.
Hey, shorts this morning. Beautiful morning. Hey, I'm really good at writing books. Well, I'm good at writing the title of books. Uh-huh. And a sky full of swallows.
Yes.
All the young swallows came out this morning, yesterday, and just dotting around all the trees. What a way to greet the dawn. Mm-hmm. With swallows everywhere, fresh raspberries off the cane. Absolutely wonderful. Get in touch with us. Tell us what you're enjoying about this wonderful Saturday morning. 0808 592 9500. Finn's here, brushed up, ready to take your calls, or you can text them on 80295 and your standard network message rate will apply.
Get heaps more coming up in the programme, as always. I've been for a visit to the Commonwealth Potato Collection down just outside Dundee. It's a fascinating thing. And I hear this is a really good news, positive story, the tale of an osprey rescue at an Angus nature reserve.
Yeah, I was digging the tatties up last night, first new potatoes of the season. It's just a great way to start. I've also been finding out how seaweed might go some of the way to improve the sustainability of our clothes. But first, and this is brilliant this week, this is, if you do anything today, stay tuned because this is wonderful. Here's the mystery bird. Now that's quite a difficult one. I wouldn't have got with that, but it is such a wonderful story at the end of the programme. If you do know, email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295 and call Finn, 0808 592 9500.
An email has flooded in. It's 6:15 really? In the morning, an email has flooded in.
Goodness me.
This is from Michael, saying, very good morning to you both. I'm up early on a Saturday today, as me and Dad are catching the train to the Scottish capital for the weekend tonight. We're going to the Royal Military Tattoo. We booked to go last year, but it was cancelled due to COVID. It'll be my fourth time at the tattoo, and each time the pipes and drums appear, the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. And as you know, this is a very special show. Also going to the Royal Yacht Britannia today and the Royal Botanical Gardens tomorrow. Great show as always, Michael in Penrith. Well, we hope you have a lovely time.
Well, I'm sure he will. Hey, I'm just going to quick hello to the two Ewans on the yacht carousel. I was going through the Crinan Canal, uh-huh, and they were singing and entertaining folk on the way. Hey, by the Pogues, you know, I found my love by the gasworks wall.
Smooth as you like. Let's move on.
Yeah, I was in Abernethy last week and I took the opportunity to speak to Uwe Stoneman of the RSPB about a study they've just completed, and it's looking at the relationship between the Capper Cayley and us.
There's definitely a lot of evidence that people and Capper Cayley interactions can be an issue and need to be managed.
So is that standing on eggs or just chasing them off the nest?
If it was as simple as that, it'd be easier to solve. People and Capper Cayley kind of like to do the same things, and, you know, they want to be on their own in the forest, in the middle of nowhere. They want to access these areas. They want to have a view. They want to be on a path. All these places are basically places that Capper Cayley like as well. So Capper Cayley would love the place we're walking along at the moment, which is a gravel path. to get some sun, for instance, or to pick up some grit.
So what's the solution then? Put up fences, don't come in here. Electric fence.
Electric fence. Well, it's not the solution for a lot of reasons, but, you know, we have Scottish Outdoor Access Code in Scotland, and quite rightly so, and it doesn't really chime with that. So it is about what the Scottish Outdoor Access Code is actually all about, which is responsible behaviour. And it is about making sure that people understand what their impact is if they do certain things.
But you've spoken to lots of people, hundreds if not thousands of people, to find out what they want from a Capper Ceilidh experience or in the forest experience.
We employed a consultant to do some research last year. That was Cairngorms National Park. It was Forest and Land Scotland, Rothy Marcus Estate, and ourselves here at Abernethy. We spoke to over 1,000 people, 1,200 people, and asked them what they are looking for when they're in the forest. What makes a good experience for them? And then we had a look at how that overlaps with where are the conflict areas with Capper Ceilidh. And the idea for the whole project is to make sure that Capper Ceilidhs can thrive, but at the same time, people can have the brilliant visitor experience that they want when they come to the Cairngorms.
What do people want then when they come to the Cairngorms?
Well, so what we found is that people fall in all sorts of different segments. And, you know, some people want to sit on a beach and have a laugh and, you know, their kids run around. Some people want to be in the forest totally on their own and have a kind of wilderness experience. Some people want to actually see Capper Ceilidh, but actually that is probably quite a small proportion. So what we need to figure out is making sure that these people can do what they want, and where there is a conflict, that area is managed. That's the idea. And it's different for all these different people.
But imagine if you've got Capper Ceilidh, a Capper Ceilidh lake at Loch Morlaisey, a couple of miles from where we are. How are you going to manage that? Because people want to get to the beach, they want to go and swim, they want to go and sail.
So there's already a lot of evidence that Capper Ceilidh are avoiding areas which are full of people. So we know, for instance, that there is a large area along a forest track that people use where that Capper Ceilidh avoid. It can be as far as 75 to 100 metres on either side of that area. So Loch Morlaisey is not an attractive place. It would have been, you know, a few hundred years ago, but it's no longer an attractive place. But there are still attractive places left. So in a way, to zone it in and say, well, you know, you can go on the beach and that's kind of fine, that kind of works. But then people also want to get on their mountain bike and go somewhere else. And that's maybe where the issues occur.
This is an easy question. How do you fix that then?
How do you fix it? What we need is understanding from people who come here and also cooperation from people. And I think the only way we can get cooperation from people is if they understand it's a win-win. The Capper Ceilidh wins because they're undisturbed and they survive, but also they win because they still get a really good visitor experience.
If the interaction with Capper Ceilidh can be 100 yards outside of this track, most folk aren't even going to know they're there.
That's right. So most folk don't know that they're there. And that's a difficulty for people who want to see Capper Ceilidh, I think. But my view on it is you don't have to see a Capper Ceilidh to have a Capper Ceilidh experience. When I walk through these forests, I walk through them a lot because I live here and I work here, I know they're there. And if you think about it, we're just actually walking up to a model Capper Ceilidh, which is life-size, made from wood. To know that there's a bird that size out there in the forest at the moment, it actually does something to me. It changes my experience.
I'd want to see it, though.
I totally understand that people want to see it. And I think if one flew across the path just now, that would be a brilliant sighting. But I'm a bird watcher. I'm not an avid twitcher, but I like seeing birds. And I do have a list that says these are the birds that I've seen in my life. But, you know, I always think if I was a bird watcher who had a year list, I would think I'm a better bird watcher if I don't have a Capper Ceilidh on there, because I've helped to conserve Capper Ceilidh.
Uwe Stoneman of RSPB Abernethy there. It's a difficult one, though, isn't it? Because, I mean, as you rightly point out, if you don't know they're there, why should you be concerned?
Yeah, I'm impressed with Uwe's you know, list of birds he hasn't seen.
It's a triumph.
I think it's a triumph, yeah. I'm right up there. My list is huge of the birds I haven't seen. Yeah. I've seen a capercaillie a couple of times in my life. And it is
close
a
up on one occasion.
Very close up. We were filming with a landlord, and they said, we spent ages looking for them. We came back, and it was beside the Land Rover. And the sound guy wanted to get some sound of that sort of noise, and he couldn't get it. He said, I'll do it. So I went in with a microphone, attacked me, pulled the furrier thing off my microphone, went through a wax jacket and a fleece and a shirt, and drew blood. Yeah. And there's some wonderful footage of me wrestling with a capercaillie. They are scary close up. You know, beaks like pliers.
Beaks like pliers. Although it has to be said that, you know, just about any species of bird, essentially. I mean, the dove of peace would probably go for you, and I'm not sure why.
Anyway. Yeah, so at least we don't complain about it.
Well, this is it. Hardly mention it. We've spoken before about walking art on this programme. Recently, Helen Needham and I went out with Dee Hedden of Glasgow University, explained it really well. By the way, Dee sent us in a book called The Walk Book, Recipes for Walking and Wellbeing, Walking Publics, Walking Arts. She probably had done about 20 artists contained within it, different ideas, they looked at what the obstacles are for actually getting out walking and then tried to find ways of surmounting those or ameliorating them or actually just making it possible to do it. And there's some really lovely ideas in that. Anyway, Amanda Thompson is an artist and writer based in Strathspey. During the lockdown, she found herself creating art from her walks, and she explained the concept to Helen.
I make what I call walk drawings, which is just stick on a GPS and just mark the walks that I make from my house. It started when I was doing my doctorate, when I was shadowing foresters and ecologists as they went about what they were doing, because if you're a forester or you're an ecologist and you're doing a particular piece of work which might involve walking transects or things like that, you have to walk it in a particular way, which is very different from just sticking to tracks. So I was really interested in how you could almost draw through walking. What I've done, and especially since lockdown, is just carry a GPS with me a lot of the time when I start off walking from my house, and just make these kind of walks that overlap or don't overlap, and you can see kind of where the tracks are. But sometimes I go away off, you know, looking for a bird or a flower or things like that. And again, actually just kind of recording where I've been to just have that record of movement.
And what are some of the shapes like then, the resulting shapes of your walking?
I think I'm amazed at how much walking I do, because obviously if you're walking a line and walking a line and walking a line, it just, the line gets thicker and thicker and darker and darker and darker. It's kind of quite nice to see how your house is just this little centre, you know, this is the centre of your world, and then where else you go. And of course during lockdown we were very limited about where we could go, so we had, it was almost like a kind of walking circles around the house every day. So it was really nice just to see how these walks gathered and see actually where favourite spots
that you were just naturally drawn to.
Yeah, naturally drawn to. And yeah, so there's a walk across the track and up a field which just gives wonderful views over to Beinachmore and a little bit of the Cairngorm. So it's always kind of from the top of that hill you can see where the first snows are. There's other tracks that you think, well, I know why I went there, because I was looking for Twinfler, for example. I couldn't necessarily say I had favourite tracks, actually, but they all have this kind of cumulative effect of just loveliness in the forest and things to see.
I wanted to talk about language, because it hadn't really occurred to me before, but so many of these old Scots terms are related to the weather.
Yes.
Why do you think that is?
Because there's a lot of weather in Scotland. In days gone by, we had to pay more attention to it. I think Kathleen Jamie said this lovely thing once, and I'm paraphrasing, so I hope it's not wrong, that all writing before the 20th century was nature writing. Do you know?
Like, yes, I think she did say that, yeah.
And at the time that the old dictionaries were, the kind of 19th century dictionaries were being compiled, everybody was in nature. You know, we had to pay attention to the weather. We had to know its nuances. We had to kind of understand You know, whether you were a fisherman or a woman out at sea, or you were a farmer, or you were just kind of walking, you had to kind of know what the weather was like and what it was going to be doing. And I love the kind of nuances of weather that you get. We just say it's rainy. We might say it's smirry or it's dreich, you know, but there's so many more words for weather that we used to use. Ouchen means to sigh or blow gently. A stour is a stiff breeze. A caver is a gentle breeze that moves the water slightly. I love lumming, which means it's pouring down. Dunfall, a heavy fall of snow. Heavy-hearted means used of the atmosphere, lowering and threatening rain. A sapless day means it's rainless and dry. So I like that, it's sap,
yeah.
Sapless. You know, isn't that lovely? Tunyatter, to rain slightly with a high wind. A landlash is a great fall of rain accompanied by a heavy wind. In Gloucestery, a day in which there is rain accompanied with a pretty strong wind. And I love how there's some of these words that are, even if you didn't know the definition or you'd never heard the word before, if I was to say it's a Gloucestery day, I'm sure you would
kind of get a sense.
You'd get a sense of it. Same with a splutery day. You know it's not going to be dry if it's a splutery day.
How would you describe today then?
Well, do you know, there's not that many words for sunny days.
Because it doesn't happen very often. It's been a bit wet.
Yeah. Has there been any skeetles?
Skeetles?
Small shower?
Yes, there's been a few skeetles earlier. What is the purpose for you to share these words, these old words?
There's a lovely poetry to them. Even if they're dictionary definitions, there's a lovely feeling and atmosphere to them that I think are just lovely. So I keep going back to them. But also, again, it's that idea of slowing down and pausing and really thinking about the details, you know. So it's not just rain, it's a particular kind of rain. It's not just wind, it's a particular kind of wind.
Amanda Thompson there. And you can hear the full conversation with Amanda, where she discusses her new book, Belonging with Helen. That's Belonging with Helen, on our midweek podcast, which is published this Wednesday coming. Go to BBC Science, look for Scotland Outdoors. And we had a complaint because I mentioned Dee Hedden's book, but I did it too fast. It's called The Walk Book, Recipes for Walking and Well-being. There you go.
The memories of my Scottish grandfather, the creator of public service broadcasting.
To coincide with the centenary of the BBC, we're sharing the tales from your family that just have to be passed down to the next generation.
So Jimmy Shan said to him, right, come on and join the band for the night.
We were allocated a palace. This palace was called a prefab.
Listen to the stories so far and share your own by heading to bbc.co.uk/radioscotland.
He could stride for miles with his shepherd's crook.
100 years of Scottish stories across 2022 on BBC Radio Scotland.
You're listening to Outdoors on BBC Radio Scotland. Coming up, how seaweed could change the fashion industry and a chance to get involved in surveying the erosion of our coastlines.
Yeah, fashion. It's not often you hear that on this programme.
Not
often. Quite a few wrong answers, which is satisfying. Bobby McCabe. Bobby knows his birds, and he's close-ish. He says, I think this week's bird sounds like a small raptor, so I'm guessing it's a sparrowhawk. No, you're wrong. And Bernie O'Connor said, morning, boys.
Bless. Thank you.
Yeah, it's worth it. Worth it for that alone. It could be a peewee. It's definitely not a peewee. First answer was getting closer. Yeah. Anyway, have a wee listen to this and see if you can work out what it is.
I wouldn't get it.
I don't know whether I should give a clue here or not.
Not yet.
I've seen one. There was a lovely wildlife police officer who studies them up in Elgin, I think it is, and he took me and showed me one. But I've never seen one in the wild. They are there. There's a lot of them, and they are fascinating creatures. And the connection, which we'll play at the end of the programme, is just astounding. Yeah. A national institution came off the back of this bird.
Quite small bird. Connor in Somerset says the mystery bird is clearly, capital letters, Tony Hart with a squeaky marker drawing the beautiful morning scene. Too easy. What was the tune again for the gallery? No, listen, one key. There's three people singing in my headphones at the one time. Just one key. Pick a key, any key. Right.
We'll bring it to you before the end of the programme.
Ron's trying to find it, Ron, even as we speak. His fingers are a blur over the desk. Far more to the daily staple of many of our diets, the humble tatty is actually much more important than you might think. Different varieties are grown all across the world, and they're an extremely important food source. The James Hutton Institute, just outside Dundee, holds the Commonwealth potato collection, and they have plans to expand. Earlier this week, on quite a hot day, in a greenhouse, I met up with John Jones in Ingelheim, who agreed to show me around.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Potato Collection. If you don't mind, please wear a lab coat and your shoes, because it's a high-health facility.
So you have to put the little plastic booties on?
I'm afraid so, I'm sorry. Trust me, it's worth it.
Okay. Wow. Right. Ingo, what am I actually looking at here?
So you're looking at the Commonwealth Potato Collection, or the CPC as we call it, and it's literally a journey of South America and Central America. These are wild species, and some of them are cultivated land races, that have been brought to the UK in the 1930s to preserve the diversity of potato.
Okay, there is such a huge range here. Is this just a historical collection, or has it got a modern use?
It's a really important collection. For us, it's a crown jewel in our research. A lot of research on biotic and abiotic stresses is based on the diversity in the Commonwealth potato collection. But also it goes broader. It's part of an international community that wants to preserve the diversity of potatoes. And in fact, it was actually the first contribution from the UK to the global seed vault in Svalbard, Norway.
So effectively, what you've got here is it's part of a Noah's Ark for plants.
Indeed, absolutely, for potato specifically.
John, you're actually standing in amongst them. What is this used for then?
It's a resource where we can find genes that provide important traits for new potato varieties, whether that's disease resistance, heat tolerance, all these things.
What are the difficulties at the moment in the potato market? Because, I mean, every other aspect of farming seems to be, you know, slogging its way uphill. Are potatoes any different?
I'm afraid not. Potato, like all the crops, has some major challenges. As John mentioned earlier on, it's disease resistance that's really important, and also the adaptation to new climate changes. So drought and water use are really important for us.
Okay. Talk me through some of these plants, because some of them seem to be, to be honest, I wouldn't have recognised them as potatoes. Some of them seem to be so, you know, covered in flowers.
So what we have here is, as you can tell, really diverse plants. Looking at the foliage, for example, here, so you have Solanum polyadenum in front of us, which is a very smelly plant. It is a really good deterrent against insects, for example. Next to us, we have Solanum pinnatisectum. Again, has some very good late blight resistance, and the foliage does not look like a potato that you would recognize.
Not in the slightest. It's almost like an ash tree, the way the leaves are actually arranged. Why are the fruits or the fruiting bodies actually contained in little plastic bags?
So what we have here is part of the rejuvenation of the Commonwealth's potato collection. So what you see in a row are typically 20 plants, you know, grown from seedlings. And to preserve the diversity, they are fertilized across these different plants to, again, preserve the diversity that we have.
In terms of biosecurity, John, you must have to be really, really, really careful here.
Yeah, sure. We don't want any pests or diseases getting in here and destroying the plants before they've had a chance to flower so that we can generate the next generation in the seed we see. Absolutely. And that's why you're wearing your boots and your lab coat.
What do you do with the seeds? How are they stored?
So the seeds will be extracted, dried, and then they go into the national seed store here where they're kept at 4 degrees. And then they are basically made available to researchers all throughout the world. So everybody who has an interest in some of these accessions can contact us. And we will give us the material to these researchers.
I once asked this question of a museum curator up in Orkney, and it's a stinker of a question. If this place were to suddenly catch fire or be facing some form of catastrophe and you had grab one plant, what plant would that be?
I would get the whole CPC collection because in seed form, they're easy to carry. So they come in small paper bags, so you would take all of them out if you can. Yeah. We don't want to lose any of them. We should point out we actually have copies of the Commonwealth potato collection at other organisations, and we hold copies from them just in case an event like you described would occur.
Can we walk up the far end,
please?
Again, you know, the colour of the flowers on these things is creams, is a really, really rich purple there with a sort of yellow centre, almost a lilac colour. There's a real scent to some of these too. It's perfumed.
And it changes throughout the day.
Really?
As different flowers open and close during the day, the scent actually changes here.
Uh-huh. Yeah. This one has almost sort of purpley leaves. It's turning off, and it has the fruiting bodies too, but it's a sort of, I don't know how you would describe that. Because that five-shaped star, the yellow centre, lilac blue, beautiful, lovely wee things. In terms of international importance, John, where does this sit?
Well, there are only four collections of this type anywhere in the world. There's one here, one in the States, one in the Netherlands, and I can't remember what the other one is right now.
In the Vavilov Institute.
Yeah, so it's one of four global genetic resources for potato breeding that all of us depend on.
It's an international collection. How much of the research is actually aimed at the international market and how much of it's aimed at the domestic market?
That's a good question. It's both. You know, a lot of the problems that UK growers are the same problems that other growers are facing as well throughout the world. You know, pest and disease pressure, the need to produce under lower input systems are common throughout agricultural systems across the world. I mean, there are some specific projects here where we're using this collection that are tailored for East Africa, where potato is a really important staple food for smallholder farmers, and we're trying to work with stakeholders in that region to at projects targeted specifically at the needs of those growers as well.
It's not a recent thing, the sort of political interest in food security, but certainly it seems to me to be ramping up. Presumably that gives added impetus to what you're trying to do.
Absolutely, and especially for potato. Potato is the third most important food crop in the world. And if you compare it to grains, it actually produces twice, if not three times, the amount of calories and usable calories. So it's really, really important for feeding a growing world population.
So we've got this fantastic genetic resource, but one of the problems we face in terms of getting the traits out of this collection into something that's useful for growers is the time it takes to do this. A conventional breeding program can take something like 15 years to go from a wild potato species into a cultivar that's in a grower's hand. So one of the things we're keen to do here is to build the International Potato Innovation Centre, or IPIC, here on the site. We see that as an industry-led focal point for research to also to speed up this process. We know that there are new tools for doing genetics, for doing breeding, that will let us go from, you know, this 15-year period down to something more like 4 or 5 years in the future. So we want to build this IPIC, this International Potato Innovation Centre, to bring researchers and growers and other stakeholders together to understand what the needs of the industry are and to get the cultivars out there far more quickly than we can right now.
John Jones and Ingo Hine of the Hutton Institute and their Commonwealth Potato Collection. Have you ever been in there?
No, I went to a fascinating thing down in Dumfries in Galloway once, where it was heritage potatoes from all over Scotland. There was about 50 different varieties. And they were selling them, and I came back with a whole pile of Shetland Blacks, or kind of Edsel Blues, is it? It was fascinating stuff. I had a dish of tatties last night, straight out the ground, bit of garlic, a bit of olive oil, and some chorizo, and it was just fantastic.
That does sound rather nice.
Such a wonderful plant.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good.
Well, certainly the James Hutton Institute this week, I'm trying to be honest, find this just now, but I'm sure they've got potatoes in practice coming up at the James Hutton Institute this coming week. I will find the details of it and give it to you later in the programme, because again, if memory serves me right, I think it is open to just about everybody. Coming up, we've got an Osprey Chicks adventure and the innovative seating arrangements at Mount Stuart Gardens on Bute.
Yeah, and they've got the mystery bird, and disappointingly, not only has somebody got it right, they've got the connection right well. Andy Ross says it's a doctoral. Fantastic answer, Andy. No, it's not. Have a listen to this, see if you can guess what it is. Yeah, I with two right answers now. This is all getting out of hand. Alistair in Elgin says, good morning, gentlemen, as usual. Last week's correct answer was an exception, and I apologise. I don't have a clue, so I'll say it's an oyster catcher.
Donald Graham from Galvin well, Side says, is it an osprey? We've got an anonymous buzzard. Mar Huntley saying, is it a goshawk? Keith, the gamekeeper from Dinner, is it a merlin? Haven't heard the clues, I've just switched on the radio. We haven't done any clues yet so far.
Haven't done any clues. They're getting very close. Yeah. Finn's taking your calls this morning. He's on 08 085 92 95 00. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, or you can text 80295 and your standard network message rate will apply.
We had a piece from the Commonwealth Potato Collection down at Invergowrie, just outside Dundee, and I mentioned potatoes in practice and I couldn't find the relevant information at the time, so here it is. Basically, it is Thursday the 11th of August at 8:30am to 4:30pm, and it is, of course, the UK's largest field event for potatoes, and it's at Balruddery Farm, Angus. You can find details if you go on to the James Hutton website, and they'll give you the information there. Now, for about 5 years, I was president of a walking charity called Paths for All. And the man who convinced me to do that was Ian Finlay, CBE. Ian was something of a human dynamo. I mean, he was just incredibly passionate about trying to make Scotland healthier and happier and more active. So it came as a terrible shock to all of us when he suddenly died in March 2021. The charity really wanted to do something in his memory. And I found out more about what they're launching from their manager, Rona Gibb, and current CEO, Kevin Laverty.
The new £1.5 million Ian Finlay Paths Fund is, I suppose it's a chance for us to really get back to grassroots, Mark. It's a chance to support path networks and communities right across Scotland. It's about improving accessibility.
Mm-hmm. Rona, tell me about Ian.
Ian was our chief officer and died very suddenly 18 months ago.
He was a lovely guy, constantly busy.
Absolutely, and this is just so perfect to recognise his memory, in that everything he did for many years was about getting people out, getting paths that people could use, making them as accessible for people as possible. So to have this in his name is just fantastic, and will give communities an opportunity to just make things easier for their people around the different areas that they have.
Where's this £1.5 million coming from?
Well, it's Scottish Government funding, Mark, and we're really pleased about that and excited. So it's part of the active travel budget through Transport Scotland, and we're hoping that we can increase and expand this in the years going forward. So it's a great start, and I think we really need this. We know that a lot of our paths have had more footfall, more people out using them, and they need upgraded, they need improvements, and we actually need more of these links, some of these desire lines that we've been using during the lockdowns.
You better explain that. I love that expression. You get laughter lines from laughter.
Okay. Well, these little trails that we walk through and we see them, they're sort of on...
Planner wanted you to go that way, but people go absolutely that way, and lots of people go that way.
People will take the route, the most direct route, the most logical route, and sometimes what we need to do is make sure we connect these with proper surfaces, make them gradient, make them accessible, and actually make the connections between different paths and trails. So desire lines are really, that's where people want to move and travel, and I think we need to recognise that and try and support these connections.
Whose idea was it to call it after Ian?
It actually came from Transport Scotland, and we were delighted because it's not something that we often think about, naming a fund in, for somebody else. And I think it just, again, recognises the work that Ian's done over many years to improve active travel and the work with Transport Scotland and communities. And I think the whole accessibility side is the thing that we're really keen to look at. And that can be about removing barriers, gates, nasty slopes, steps, and making things much more accessible for everybody. So it could be somebody with a pram, it could easily be somebody in a wheelchair or using a mobility scooter. It's about getting paths that people are using regularly but just are a bit unloved, and give them a bit of love and care, and bring them up to a spec where people are going to be using them much more, so they will think about walking and cycling first before they'll think about going in their car for local journeys. And making sure that we have the connections for bus stops, for train stations, if those are available, but also to get kids to school, to get to the doctors, to get to the shops, so that we have nicer places, places with seats so people can take a rest, lighting if that's appropriate. It's also about cutting back vegetation. I mean, you don't often think, and that's a safety factor for many people. It makes them concerned about who's maybe lurking about because they can't see for any distance. So it will be about moving vegetation back, cutting, you know, higher canopies so that more people can use it easily without getting whacked in the face by something. So it's a whole range of things within this, but the bottom line really is about communities being able to bring back paths into good use for a lot more people.
So community groups will be able to apply for funding. You know, what sort of sums of money are we talking about?
Yeah, well, the fund offers, you know, from 10,000 up to 100,000 mark. So there's a real range of opportunity there. And I suppose it's got flexibility. So it could be a small path project or it could be a more ambitious project. And we're also looking at some projects that could develop in year one, but then move on to further enhancements in year two. So this really can be flexible and fit with what communities and what local people need. But it's also a fund that can be eligible for colleges, you know, for education establishments, for development trusts, for community interest companies. So this is about a grassroots fund, you know, for communities. And there's not enough of that out there. For me, one of the things I'm really passionate about is that walking is one of the best things that we can do to reduce carbon. So with better paths and with better walking networks, more of us can take the active choice, which is good for our health, but it's also really good for the planet.
One of the things I really like about this is its democratic nature. I think that would really have appealed to Ian, because I mean, Ian knew everybody from senior politicians right down to members of the local walking group in the back of beyond.
Absolutely, and I think that's why we're so excited about this. It's something that, for those of us who've been working in this industry for a long time, we haven't had a fund like this before, and it's been something that we've been really keen to get. So to have it now, to have it in Ian's name, just feels very fitting. And I think, as you say, it's very democratic. It is that whole just getting everybody together. And we've been working with so many communities already who've been on much smaller scale projects, who are ready to move to something bigger and link together with the other opportunities that there are, because local authorities and others have different funding pots. So this is about building that jigsaw of all the opportunities and giving the communities their opportunity to be part of that.
Yeah, and other charities can also apply, Mark, so I think that's really quite powerful. You know, we work in partnership, and I think we're working closely with Living Streets and Ramblers Scotland, and what we're keen to do is to really make sure the message about walking gets out there. We want a walking nation, and paths are absolutely essential if we want to get more people taking that sort of active choice. So let's get out, let's walk more, and let's try and make that a daily routine, something that we don't have to think about. For me personally, I think about most journeys are under 3 kilometres. That's walkable. We don't have to take the car. And with the increase in fuel costs and the cost of living crisis, now is the best time to make those kind of changes in behaviour and try and make walking the normal and the daily choice for everyone.
Kevin Laverty there and Rona Gibb from Paths for All. And that new fund that actually launches this coming Tuesday, and there's a link from our website to the Paths for All site if you would like to find out more.
No, it's brilliant. A lot of people getting in touch about the mystery bird. Folk are getting close. Well, Malcolm and Colin Shrive didn't even get close. He says it was an avocet. No, it's not. Katie in Perth, but thanks you for trying. Katie in Perth thinks it's a bird of prey.
Well, that fairly narrows it down a bit, Katie. Yeah.
Does it have feathers? Yes, it does. Is it a kestrel? No, it's not, Katie. Ken McKinnon in Drum the Drocket says it's a merlin. Sandy in Dunlugis. Morning, Sandy. Morning, men. The bird is a peregrine falcon. Keep up the good work. Well, we'll keep up the good work, but sadly it's not a peregrine falcon, but folk are beginning to circle round it.
Yep. Susan Topping from Kirriemuir thought it might be a long-eared owl, which is actually a very good suggestion. Now, we tire. I mean, it gets really exhausting. The number of times we, you and I, get asked for fashion advice. You know, because frankly, we've got better things to do with our time. We were taken, however, with a story from SAMS, the Scottish Association for Marine Science, based near Oban, because they've been exploring the use of seaweed dye in the textile industry.
Yeah, because it is quite a challenge. I mean, I have to get up an hour early to get, you know, to kind of pick which pair of shorts to wear in the morning. Anyway, this is a great example of how collaborations can come about and how to get the fashion industry involved in using sustainable, natural dyes. I went along to Sam's to meet Professor Michelle Stanley and director of the textile company Crewbag, Jessica Giniotti.
So Crewbag is a company I started after graduating studying marine science here in Scotland, and it's all about developing textiles inspired by marine science, inspired by the ocean. We collaborate with marine scientists, and the idea is to reveal the unseen beauty of the ocean and communicate important science and environmental stories to inspire deeper connection with nature. The fashion industry is a polluting industry. We have synthetic dyes, you know, derived from petroleum that land into the waterways, into the rivers and the ocean, and they don't degrade and they, you know, they pollute. Also, we need to move away from an industry that is based on the oil and gas. And I think that creating textiles and dyes that are more thoughtful, that are kinder to nature, that come from nature but in a smarter way, because this is not new, that we've been working with, you know, natural materials in the past. I think it's important to create, we're trying to develop a dye, so we don't have a commercial solution yet. We are very early stages in our R&D process, but we're trying to develop a dye that comes from seaweed, that we don't use any solvents, that is all natural, and that can go back into the water and integrate and biodegrade without any issues. And I think that's a big contribution. We can support the fashion industry in becoming more sustainable.
Michelle, that's presumably where you come in, because there's a whole wealth of dyes. I mean, people have been using dyes from the sea for a long time.
Yeah, and the classic example in Scotland is Harris Tweed. So Harris Tweed was, at one stage, they used a seaweed called Palmaria palmata, more commonly known as dullus, and that was used to produce a red pigment. You know, people are going back and looking at what we used to do and how we used to dye fabrics.
So is it seaweeds you're looking at? Because I can see the browns, I can see the reds, and I can see the greens, but I suppose the occasional purple.
So it is seaweeds we are looking at, and it's, you're not maybe going to cover the whole colour palette, but I think, you know, if you can exchange part of that, then it's worthwhile doing. I mean, it's not just seaweeds. There's interest in seaweeds relatives. They're small microalgae as well, and there's been interest in using pigments in fabric dyeing there as well. So it's all of this is very early stage, as Jessica said.
Is it scalable? Because there's been a lot of controversy about harvesting kelp, for example, from the sea. Could you scale the algae? Could you scale the dulse? Could you scale the different seaweeds?
So what we're interested in is the cultivation. So not, you know, going out and what we would describe as wild harvest, because again, you know, the amount you'd have to, you know, harvest would never make the demand. As things go on, we're starting to get a bit smarter about how we use biomass, whether it's marine biomass or plant land biomass, and it's probably part of a what we would describe a biorefinery concept. So it's using all of the material, so it's not just say taking a pigment out, but then using what's left over and seeing if you've got a use for that as well.
This is an area, let's say the West Coast, much needed jobs, environmentally friendly industry with a big potential. I mean, it's quite an exciting time to be involved in this.
It is, and you just have to see what's happening on the West Coast. You know, we're getting more farms, seaweed farms set up. At the moment, they're looking at the kelp, so the large brown seaweeds, and even where we are here in Oban, you know, you've got one farm off the end of Kerrera. You know, Mull and Iona have set up Skye as well, Barra. So you can see it the industry developing along the West Coast.
For the fashion industry, you've got feelers out at the moment. You've said it's very early days. But are they interested? Are they ready for Scottish browns, Scottish purples, Scottish reds?
I think they are. I think there is actually a good momentum. We showcased the seed eyes in London as Future Fabrics Expo recently, last month actually, and we had a huge, huge success. So we are at the moment discussing potential projects with large textile companies, and we have a waiting list of brands, international brands, interested in testing seed eyes. And I think it's about the story that we are also using a local seaweed, that we are not just looking at the process of developing sustainable dyes, but that we are also looking into how we source in the biomass, and the industry is ready for it. So we are now trying to keep that momentum and working, hopefully find the right partners. And I think it's an important time in history, and Scotland can be a player. There is a role for SAMS and for Krubak to fill a gap in the industry and develop these dyes. Hopefully, if we manage, we're still early days, so we can't make any promises.
But something satisfying about taking a part of our Celtic culture and then not reinventing it, but just bringing it to a new audience.
Oh, it's very exciting. I mean, you know, I've been working with seaweeds for about 26 years. And it is very exciting just, you know, finding new things for them and actually just developing what we can do, you know, where there are maybe some niches. And actually it's the diversity as well. I mean, I think, you know, people go to a beach and go, oh, there's just that brown seaweed there. But, you know, if you have a closer look, you know, there's lots of different species that grow in Scottish waters. And, yeah, it is very exciting.
Professor Michelle Stanley there, Associate Director for Science, Enterprise and Innovation at SAMS. And we also heard from Jessica Giannotti of Krupak.
It's fantastic. You know, so, I mean, we're rapidly becoming advocates for seaweed on this programme. Mm-hmm. There is so much out there. It's so exciting, the potential. And they're just lovely colours, you know, subtle colours, the Harris tweeds, the tartans. You know, I just love that, reaching to your past to bring it to a future.
As I said, you know, they used to use lichens and things like that, so it makes perfect sense to me. If you are a lover of the northeast coastline here in Scotland, there's a project that you might very well like to get involved with. They're looking for volunteers to update surveys of heritage sites around the coast which are at risk from erosion. Now, joining us now is Dr. Sarah Boyd of the SCAPE Trust, S-C-A-P-E. Sarah, does that stand for anything?
Good morning. Yes, it does actually. It stands for the Scottish Coastal Archaeology and the Problem of Erosion, which is a bit of a mouthful, so usually we just go by SCAPE.
Well, what does it do?
So, we're a small charity and we work closely with the University of St Andrews and also Historic Environment Scotland. And our aim in a nutshell is to record, research, investigate, and ultimately promote and learn from Scotland's coastal heritage and our archaeology. Working with the public and with volunteers from local communities, it's really at the heart of what we do and is what we really enjoy doing. And so our most latest project is these coastal heritage surveys. We're working our way around the Murray and Aberdeenshire coasts. And we're really interested in adding, as you said, adding to your understanding of the heritage along those coastlines and recording new sites if we discover them.
Give us an example of the heritage sites that are potentially under threat from coastal erosion.
Oh, so from we started east of Inverness about April. We'll be moving away round to Murray. There's so many types of sites at the coast, and some you might even think about. But what we've discovered in this coastline is many sites showing the strong fishing heritage along this coastline. So in the intertidal zone, for example, we've come across large boulder-built fish traps of all different shapes and sizes. We've got multiple sort of post wooden alignments that you see stretching into the sea that are also to do with past fish nets and fish sticks. I've come across parts of crafts and wooden vessels which have been abandoned and are deteriorating in the intertidal muds, or and even, you know, wrecks that have swept up in the sands of Colban, for example. It's not just fishing heritage, though. There's evidence of other industry. We've come across a 17th century, or it might be even earlier, tide mill, and, you know, foundations of those buildings which have since disappeared. And also, jumping forward in time, this coastline has a very rich military history. So we've come across many sort of anti-glider post down at Culbin and White Ness Head, anti-tank blocks and pillboxes all the way around to Burgh Head, where we've got to. So there's a lot of heritage at the coastline, maybe even more than people think about, and that heritage is naturally very vulnerable to coastal processes. You know, it's a very dynamic environment.
How are you actually going to record the difference between, you know, you must have some sort of benchmark, you must have some sort of record how it was, in your, and then how are they going to record how it is now?
Yes, yeah, so we do assign priorities to sites. So where this is a new survey in this area, we've done many surveys before in the past in other areas of the coastline. We've covered about 35% of the coastline so far, and this is a new area. But we have got the existing heritage records of sites that are known about from national and regional archive databases. And we have an app that we use in the field. So in our app, we have maps of the coastline with those databases in there. And we can find those sites and we'll update descriptions of them and update photographs and the condition report of them as of now. This is a new baseline of that coastline as of 2022. But also, we do try and assign priority to sites, and that's based on whether it's a site of particular archaeological significance, but also if it's a site that's particularly vulnerable to coastal erosion. And so on our website, we actually have a sites at risk map of thousands of archaeological sites, not just here, but all along the north coast, northeast coast, but all around Scotland, that you can look at and explore the heritage in your local coastline.
But what can you do about it? I mean, it's all very well to identify a site and say this is potentially under threat from coastal erosion, but is anybody responsible for preserving it or logging it or stopping the erosion, or do you just watch it and accept that this is the sea, this is what happens?
It's a mixture, but a lot of the time we want to learn from the heritage that we can see at the coastline now and discover new heritage that has the coastline now with our volunteers and really learn from the coastline. So yes, it's projected with future climate models and rising sea levels that processes like coastal erosion are going to get worse in the future. And there's so much heritage around the coastline that you can't protect everything. Maybe a very significant site you could defend, but in the majority of sites, what we really want to do is learn from those sites now and take coastal erosion as a learning experience for us, and to be able to learn from the coast as sites are revealed along the coastline, and to really focus in on documenting what we can see now, because it might be in the future that some of those sites won't exist for that much longer. And so we are really trying to document those heritage sites and try and tell a hidden history of the coastline.
And if folk want to volunteer here, Sarah, if they want to get involved in this, how do they?
Perfect. Yes. To get involved, the best thing to do is to head to our website at the minute. So that would be www.scapetrust.org. And here you can find all the details about our surveys and how to get involved. I just want to say you don't have to have any previous experience. It's great if you've got local knowledge of an area. That's really helpful to us to help tell a story and understand and learn from the different sites. But if you don't have experience, that's fine. It's sort of a journey of discovery as we go along the coastline and find out about these sites.
For everybody involved. Sarah, thank you very much for your time this morning. That was very kind of you.
No problem, thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Sarah Boyd there of the Scape Trust. And I'm fairly certain we'll link to their website from ours on the BBC Radio Scotland website. You are listening to BBC Radio Scotland. This is Out of Doors. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. It is incredible to me that anyone misses any of this programme, but it does occasionally happen. And if so, there are a few who are listening again.
Yep, you can catch up whenever you like by looking up the programme on BBC Sounds. Or if you can't do that, we will come round with a cassette and put it into your machine for you.
Cassette. We do like hear where you listen. Get in touch and tell us where you are, which is what David McGregor in Canada did. He says, "Hello, lads from Calgary. Great show as always. Listening to the podcast while enduring the current sweltering heat in southern Alberta. 32 degrees centigrade as I write this with a fan going full blast. One of the things I love about your programme in particular, and one of you mentioned it about the Clachnacuthan Stone, is that I learn lots of things about places I think, brackets incorrectly, that I already know a lot about."
Yeah, you're not alone there. He goes on to say, "Your mystery bird was one I recognised in seconds this week, as when we lived in Langbride before moving to Canada, there was a rookery. It's a funny, harsh sound, but I find it really comforting. And, as you said, watching rooks wheeling across the sky is one of nature's greatest spectacles. Anyway, just a quick message to say hello, keep up the good work, and I'm already looking forward to next Saturday's podcast. In the meantime, I have about 300 podcasts to listen to in the archive, if there's enough Scotland in my week. Cheers for now, David Robertson."
The sun is shining! My legs are out!
This August, BBC Radio Scotland returns to the Edinburgh Festivals.
It truly is such a thrill, and I think it's shared by everyone here and wherever you're listening, to actually be back.
Bringing you live music.
You've got us vibing in the front and the back.
Conversation.
It's been a mind-stretching, thought-provoking session. Thank you very much.
Comedy.
Have you ever had to buy something you didn't want to?
Bought a skusher perfume from a nightclub attendant.
And everything in between.
We are revelling in the Edinburgh Festival. How are you doing?
Coverage continues Monday on BBC Radio Scotland and BBC Sounds.
Just a reminder that we are going to be taking out of doors to the Edinburgh Festival this year. We'll be coming to you live on Saturday the 13th of August. And if you are keen to come along, and please bear in mind, it does kick off at 6:30 in the morning. But set your alarm clocks early and apply for tickets now.
Yeah, now listen carefully. We will give this again, but go to bbc.co.uk/shows and tours. Go to the shows section on the site and search Edinburgh Festivals. The link's also on our programme page. So that's bbc.co.uk/shows and tours. I have done this, so it's doable. Go to the shows section on the site and search for Edinburgh Festivals. And then there's a big picture of Mark and I. Click on that and it'll let you apply for tickets.
Hopefully. Among the guests joining us will be outdoor author and broadcaster Carmen McNeish. And clearly, there's been a degree of discontent with my skills with a frying pan. So we've got MasterChef semi-finalist and outdoor enthusiast Sarah Rankin coming along to cook breakfast. Giving us the lowdown, the history of old Reiki will be Fraser Parkinson. And making the most of the great outdoors is Anna Noidat Wood, a Wonder Woman. So please, if you get a chance, if you're in Edinburgh, if you fancy getting up at 6:30 in the morning, you know, and coming along to the St James Centre, come and join. Come and join us. Come and join. I must get a
I love that Wonder Woman thing, isn't it?
Brilliant.
Fantastic.
Absolutely.
Hey, mystery bird. Gordon Brown and Effie Bridge says, "Is it a Merlin?" Gordon, you're so close. Marles McLean says, "Is it a peregrine falcon?" I think it might be a young one. Or possibly a female. I'm adding that bit on. Hey, you're close. Doogie from Dot from the Isle of Arran. Morning, gents. My Mrs. Dot reckons it's a squeaky wheel. Love the show. And Mike in Dalsif says, "Is it an avocet?" It's definitely not an avocet.
Oh, we see. This is have interesting. They're coming in. Well, hang on. Before you have a listen, Heather from Linlithgow says, "Red kite." Nope. Stephen from Canvas Barron says, "Missed an opportunity to impress the family with a correct answer last week because I wasn't listening live." Probably on the wrong answer. "Is the mystery bird a peregrine falcon?" Nope. Karen and Son Shetland thinks it's a mystery farming implement. It's an old peat barrow that's in need of some oil for its squeaky wheel. And Daniel and Forfa thought it might be a red kite. So, no. But look, here's what it sounds like.
I think it is a wheelbarrow.
Could be.
Give Finn a call, 0800.
Last Monday was yet another highlight of the agricultural calendar in Scotland. I mean, certainly it's the highlight, I think, in the northeast of Scotland. It was the Tara Show last Sunday and Monday. But it wasn't the visit of Her Royal Highness Princess Anne, or indeed the magnificent display of livestock and machinery, that piqued my interest. I was entirely led by my gut in this instance. It took me to a cooking demonstration being given by Gary McLean, who is Scotland's national chef.
But the first thing I actually want to do is I want to get the tatties on for the lamb dish that I'm doing. And the tatties that I'm making are chips, but they're going to be chips with a difference. So I got a beautiful saddle of lamb yesterday, and what I did was I rendered all the fat off the lamb. So I'm going to make chips with the lamb fat. So lamb fat chips. So, are we ready?
Yes!
Thank you.
You are doing well to stand behind this table because you could get trampled underfoot all the way.
I think so. And every time I do a demo, I try and make more and more and more just so that everybody, you know, get a full sensory experience. You know, taste is important.
Just talk me through this. What have we got on the table in front
right,
of us?
Right, so we've got some macaroon. So macaroon is icing sugar, potato, chocolate and coconut. Four ingredients. I just think it's magical. It's an incredible thing to make and so easy. Next along is we've got beautiful green veg, including things like Brussels sprouts. We've got some local mushrooms, fit for fungus, I've supplied them. Married that, we've got a bit of the lamb fat through there as well. So just a beautiful combination. And then probably the best thing on the table is our Scotch lamb.
Which looks fabulous.
It's incredible. So the full saddle of lamb, that's one of the loins that come off it. But, I mean, you can still smell it. It's tender, full of flavour.
I'm standing on the wrong side.
I know,
of the
you're
table.
On the wrong side of the table.
And then you have the dessert.
Yeah, so the idea of the dessert was to try and get at least 10 of the producers that are in the hall onto a plate just to show the quality. Mm-hmm. And a little dish like that, I don't normally do in demonstrations. That's a restaurant, maybe a chef's conference type dish that I would present. I just thought it was important just to show everyone, this is all bread and butter cooking, this is all traditional Scottish and tasty and wholesome. This is a wee bit posh and it kind of shows how far the ingredients can go.
How much of this, Gary, is actually to do with promoting local producers and things? You mean, okay, you're at the Turra Show, you could be expected to do it here, but how much do you do it in your day-to-day life?
It's my living, every day, every day. Scotland's national chef, so I did macaroon 3 weeks ago in Alaska, you know, for hundreds of American Scots who are desperate to find out more about their own heritage, their own Scottish history, and the reaction's no different. The reaction's no different.
How do you get to be Scottish national chef? It's a bit like being a macker for poetry.
It is, yeah. This was something that was kicking around government for a while, and it's part of the Good Food Policy Act that is slowly but surely coming through. And basically, winning MasterChef helped a little. I was getting interviewed by Kate Devine, the great Kate Devine, and she mentioned, she says, you know, is that something you would consider? And I thought, you know, it would go to, you know, the great and the good, you know, the Tom Kitchens of the world and stuff like that. And a few weeks later, I got a call from the government. So, but the whole role itself, to be honest, a lot of it's to do with working with young people. I'm really passionate about young people learning to cook. I think it's vital that our kids understand food and can learn to cook. Because I think in the long-term health of the nation, if people can make a pot of soup or understand how to roast a chicken, you know, cook from fresh, it makes a massive difference.
Very often, that kind of education, to my mind, doesn't go to the wrong kids, but the kids that really, really need it don't get it. You seem to be addressing that.
I hope so. I hope so. And yeah, for a long time, we've spoke about home economics turning into hospitality and trying to get people into the industry. I think we have to bring it back, and it has to include everyone, even the kids that don't want to go into hospitality, want to be engineers, doctors, lawyers. Everyone needs to learn to cook. And the ones that enjoy and see the benefits of food as a job will naturally find their way, like I did. I'm a product of a good home economics teacher, and that's it.
Gary McLean, Scotland's national chef there. And, of course, Gary won MasterChef, the professionals, back in 2016. And we'll have another MasterChef semi-finalist, Sarah Rankin, joining us live in Edinburgh next week. Remember, you can still apply for tickets, as we were telling you, and there is a link on our website. Anyway, we were talking fast fashion and clothing dyes earlier in the programme. We will move seamlessly now, not onto designer brands, but designer benches. A couple of weeks ago, Maud Stark travelled to a rather rainy, it was torrential, Butte, to meet with the curator at Mount Stuart House and Estate, Morven Gregor, who explained what makes this fancy outdoor furniture quite so special.
OK, hot topic here at Mount Stuart is benches.
Yes.
Let's talk about them.
Yes, well, we are delighted this summer to be hosting a bench project run by Design Exhibition Scotland and started by Susanna Beaumont. And we are hosting 5 prototype benches that we hope might find their way into the wider world after they've enjoyed the summer here.
Okay, what is it about a bench that is so important?
I think from Susanna's point of view, it was very much that it's both a convivial kind of space so that you can sit there and chat with somebody, maybe friends, or maybe just start up a conversation with somebody you don't know. But also it's a kind of safe space that you don't feel overexposed in if you're sitting there on your own. So somewhere that you can have a picnic or read a book or something along those lines. And I think, you know, post-COVID, it's just quite a nice, gentle way to think about being with other people in basically the public realm.
And also the connection with nature as well. You're sitting out here and it's like a little bit of familiar in out here in this really tropical rainforest.
Yeah. And I think in particular we've been quite thoughtful about where we'll site each of the winning benches. So for this one, for example, that we're at just now, you can see it's got a great long view, but we've got a wee bit of shelter for a wet day like today, but also for a super hot day there's a bit of shelter as well.
What is this view? I can see a big column with a statue on top. Who's that?
Yeah, that is a statue to Augusta. She was the Queen Mother, the mother of George III, and together with the third Earl of Bute, they founded Kew Gardens. So he had this monument to her and her endeavours on that in that regard created here. I think there's a portrait of him in Kew Gardens, but he was very interested in all things botanical.
So the perfect place to put a bench. Let's talk about this bench. So at the moment it's two big stone plinths, which I imagine is going to be the base of the bench.
Well, these are very fascinating because they are actually going to be the benches. The winning duo that are creating these benches are Dressed for the Weather, which is Andy Campbell, and Stephanie Chong, who's a jeweller who works in stone. And what they were interested in was thinking very much of the geology of the island of Bute, which, as you can, well, sometimes see and maybe know, there's a lot of Devonian sandstone here. So their starting point was to work with blocks of sandstone, which they would then work into being their benches. And this sandstone they sourced from the local quarry, which actually had recycled it from a large church in the town that was being demolished. So Stephanie and Andy found two perfect blocks, and they are cutting them into shape, but you can maybe see that there's a kind of cut out sort of squiggly shape, a bit like a cloud, which is smoothed off. And that's because that's weighting the next element of these particular benches, which is going to be a sort of seating area, because as we know stone can be a bit cold here, and that seating area is going to be made from recycled plastic that's kind of compressed into, again, to make a nice smooth and comfy surface.
So a lovely meeting of one really ancient material and one really, well, recent material.
Yeah, and I think they're kind of provoking us in some way, or sort of problematising our era, and now that we're starting to call that the Anthropocene, and, you know, what is our footprint going to be? All this horrid plastic. Well, at least these guys are taking this waste product and recycling it. But there is that kind of conversation and that kind of contrast with the very ancient, formed over millions of years kind of stone.
It'll be interesting to see which lasts longer, the stone or the plastic. So where are these? Is this bench going to stay here, or is this going further afield?
Yeah, no, these two benches are going to stay here because it is quite an idyllic situation. The rubble here, actually, that's at our feet, because it's still a work in progress, that's going to be recycled to be the ballast in somebody else's bench, which is going to be over in the forecourt of the house. Another one is going to be at the side of the house, giving views over the front lawn. And then another one is going to be quite far away at the end of a long avenue, so it'll have really quite a dramatic aspect. And then there is a fifth bench, which has been commissioned by a well-established maker, James Rigler, and it's going to be inside the Marble Hall, so people will be able to sit on it in there.
Which is where we should go right now, right now, with this rain.
Maud Start and Morven Gregor at Mount Stuart on Bute. That's a really nice idea.
Yeah, there's nothing better than a bench.
You know, you've got to a certain age when you think, oh, there's nothing better than a bench. A wee Cernus flask and maybe a big slipper.
I'm standing up broadcasting, I guess, and you're sitting down.
Yeah, well, I've got the bacon to cook. You know, it's constant for me, you know. Last week, Ewan was hearing how an osprey nest in the Cairngorms was refitted to be a des res for some birds up there. This week, I was at the Scottish Wildlife Trust Bulgaria's Nature Reserve in Angus, where recently they had something of an osprey nest drama. I spoke to Ranger Raz Rasmussen, who told me the story.
We received a call on the 20th of July that the nest, or the tree that supports the nest, had split, and the nest had collapsed with it. And a young osprey fledgling was no longer on the nest, but had been found on the path nearby that surrounds the loch.
How did it manage to survive the fall?
Well, we think because it was very close to fledging, it probably part glided, part flapped its way. We don't know if it landed in the water or managed to get its way to the edge, but had somehow found its way onto the edge of the path that surrounds the loch.
And who found it?
A couple of locals that are regular here walk their dog most mornings, so Mary and Jim Rogers were lucky enough to come across the osprey first thing in the morning. Probably not what they expected to find at 7:30.
Now, explain this to me. You know, the bird has made it successfully out of the nest, but it hasn't done what it's supposed to have done, which is flown itself out of the nest.
Yep.
The nest has kind of collapsed underneath it.
Yep.
It's on the ground. Could it have taken off from there?
It would probably struggle, to be honest. Osprey young, when they're practicing fledging, they spend a good week or two building up their muscles,
their
flight muscles.
Up and down
they do this helicoptering up and down until they have the courage and the strength to be able to take their first maiden flight. So not having that height or that uplift from any breeze and wind would have made it quite hard for the osprey to take off. And it was in quite an enclosed area with the trees as well, so I think it would have struggled to take off from there.
So Mary and Jim find it.
Mm-hmm.
Who do they report?
So we're fortunate here that we've got the wonderful Jim Hughes as the warden on the reserve, lives nearby, so they know Jim and got in touch with him, and he came to the rescue, and they got a plan together to basically scoop up the osprey and carefully take it to a nice, safe, quiet place where it was popped in a cage and a wee blanket over it just to keep it nice and calm before we got it checked out for any injuries.
You've got the osprey, it's safe, you've checked it, there's nothing broken.
Yep.
Super, fantastic. What next?
So next was really looking at what are the options for the osprey, and I'm a member of the Tayside and Fife Raptor Study Group, so I got in touch with colleagues from there who are more experienced than myself to see if they'd come across anything similar. And the recommendation was to build a temporary platform up high and to be able to get the youngster back up into that. And in the past, where nests have collapsed, they've had success where the parents can see the youngster, they can come in and feed it, and then when it is ready, it can do its proper maiden fledging from that higher point. So that was the kind of course of action that we took.
That must have been quite quickly thought of and executed.
Yes, it was. There was a lot of phone calls that day, to-ing and fro-ing and scrabbling around.
No, I don't have a nest.
Yeah, looking for bits of equipment. So the kitchen sink was gathered, and we had people that were kind enough to ferry our canoe over from Loch of the Lows, and gathering bits of pieces, and Jim supplied us with a basket which we thought would do the job.
What kind of basket?
Just a wire basket.
Right.
And
it's like a shopping basket type thing, but
bigger. Kind of, as if it didn't have the handles on it.
You put it up the tree.
So we're very generously, James Sylvie and Robin Manson from the Tayside and Fife Raptor Study Group gave up their evening, quite a long evening, to drive over here. They've got all the climbing kit and the licensing to be able to deal with the osprey. So they scoped out the area for a suitable tree, picked one that they thought would do the job, climbed up it, prepped the tree and so on, secured the basket.
Was that without incident? Because I've read your blog and I know it wasn't.
Yes. They did have a bit of a run-in with some wasps on the way. So bless them, they both took a couple of hits from wasps on the first tree that they checked out. So they opted for this other tree that they thought might be a little bit easier. So that took quite a bit of time to be able to sort that out.
And then, of course, you've got to get the bird up in the basket.
That's right.
And but before then, you'd actually ringed it as well.
Yeah, so we had to transport the osprey from Jim's place where it was secure in its cage. We got the canoe in position, so very carefully canoed the osprey across. So we didn't have to take on the wasps. We did have a couple of angry swans initially that we had to clear out the way. So it was all happening.
Wildlife is not your friend, really, is it?
Wildlife and children, they say, don't work with. Yeah. So given that Robin and James are both licensed ringers, it seemed like a good opportunity to have the bird ringed and weighed and so on. So Robin did the deed, and it was
ringed.
But
you held it?
Yes, I got to, yeah, just
help
secure it.
What's that like, holding a young osprey?
Incredible, yeah. Very, very humbling. You've got this, you know, a wild creature looking at you with its burning orange eye just next to your head, just looking at you, going, this is not my normal day.
What are you doing?
Yeah, and it was very, very calm. You know, we're just kind of holding the wings, essentially, just mm-hmm. to stop it flapping, because it was, you know, ready to go. And yeah, you could feel its heartbeat underneath the hands. It was, yeah, it was incredible, yeah.
So they ring it? They get it up in the wire basket,
yep.
up the tree,
yep.
some distance up the tree,
yep.
the one without the wasps. Did it work? I mean, did the parents find it?
So it was very late at night when we left. The parents were kicking around, they were circling and watching what we were doing, but it was getting dark as we left, so we didn't expect them to come in that day. But we got a call the next day from Jim the warden to say that actually the youngster had fledged from the temporary nest.
Oh,
yeah, and it was on the island with its parents shouting for food, which is, yeah, it's the best result that you can hope for. But we have seen subsequently that the parents are actually going into that nesting site and adding a bit of material to it.
Interesting.
Yeah. yeah.
This new artificial
yeah,
one, because
yeah.
of course the other one's gone.
That's
it.
The other
fell
one's
into
gone.
The loch, more
yep,
or less.
Yep, yep.
Just out of curiosity, I mean, I know from past dealings with SWT, Scottish Wildlife Trust, you kind of have a philosophy of not interfering with nature.
Yep.
Let nature take its course.
Absolutely.
This was different, though. I mean, it was so close to actually coming to fruition.
Absolutely. I mean, as we saw, the bird was days from fledging. If we had left it on the path, there were chances that, you know, there might have been a dog had come along and, you know, injured it, or it may have, you know, scuttled off into the bushes and then got predated by something. We felt that it was pretty clear-cut that we needed to get it up high and nature could then take its course. It just needed that little nudge to complete that cycle and all the hard effort of the parents raising it over the summer.
Raz Rasmussen from the Scottish Wildlife Trust there. As I said, a really positive, good news story, and well done to everyone involved.
What a fantastic tale, and a lot of quick thinking as well, because mm-hmm. it's yeah. a pretty short time scale
yeah.
to actually whack a nest up there, because we were talking about Roy Dennis building a nest, or recommending building a nest in Abernethy Forest, but to get that nest up there, being stung by wasps, I mean, that's real heroic.
Attacked by swans, you name it. No, I must give it, you know, if somebody came up to you and said, right, we need an osprey nest, we need it by this evening, what are we going to use? Where would you start? I mean, the best thing I could come up with was a pallet.
Oh, I was thinking of a laundry basket.
Laundry baskets, yeah, it's quite good.
Here's a bizarre conversation we never thought we were going to have at half past six.
When we collectively woke up this morning, yeah. Never mind. Listen, we've got heaps of, I mean, bizarrely, heaps of correct answers have actually come in for this week's mystery bird.
OK, after well, you. David Chadwick and Carl Luke, Tricia Heaton, Kenny McLean and East Kilbride. He also got the connection to the well, it's coming up in a minute. Alistair White said, good morning from sunny Eyemouth. Not many raptors, apart from a regular visit from a sparrowhawk. Sandy Adam in Creef, Malcolm in Edinburgh, and Morag from Turin. The Dreich one, not the sunny one.
Dreich Turin, not the Italian Turin.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, no, we've got great answers from Mike near Bewley, as I said. He's still in bed with Hector the Hound, trying to get him to move. Andrew Barry, Roman Camp, West Golding, got it correct. Janet from Perth, Linda from Green Loaning, Alistair, Nicky Leaven, John McKenzie in Orkney, Mary in a cloudy pit lockery, Stuart Taylor in Elgin, Graham in Denny, Alan Marks, and the first one to get it right, apparently, this morning, was Derek listening in Forth.
But the correct answer was, of course, the hobby. There was high excitement in the Office of Intellectual Property in the government. The year was 1947. And a game had arrived in the post. A new game, which attracted the attention of the office clerks. An old blanket was spread on the massive teak table in the boardroom, and so the match began. Little blue and red men of cardboard stuck onto buttons weighed down with washers were arranged on the blanket marked out with chalk. The game's arrival had already been announced in the August 1946 edition of the boys' own magazine. And it finally went on sale in 1947. The inventor, Peter Adolf, was trying to get it patented. Adolf was a keen bird watcher, a watcher especially of raptors, and one raptor in particular. For the young Peter was particularly keen on watching Britain's smallest bird of prey, the hobby. The tiny riphook, as it was once known, is an amazing bird. The northern hobby, or just the hobby, is similar in size to a kestrel, but it's got a shorter tail, long sickle-shaped wings, and distinctive rusty red trousers. It's incredibly fast, up to 160 kilometres an hour. Fast enough, and more importantly, dexterous enough to take a swallow on the wing. And it's thought that the English name, the hobby, may be derived from the old Dutch hobben, meaning to move up and down or side to side due to its incredible acrobatic flying ability. The hobben also gave its name to the hobby horse, which also slides from side to side. It's a summer visitor, which flies low, very low, always scanning the sky above, not just for swallows or martins, but also for dragonflies, which are also caught and sometimes eaten in flight. They're opportunistic feeders, with a wide variety of insects and around 96 species of bird documented as prey items. Large eyes allow the hobby to be very active at dusk when it's successful in hunting bats and insects in the twilight, well after sunset. And rather than build their own nests, hobbies rely on those built by other species, such as crows. Two or three eggs are normally laid in June, hatching 4 weeks later, and are fully independent by the end of the summer. But back to Peter Adolf. The game, his creation, was addictive, skillful, and captured the mood of the time. He wanted to name it after his favourite bird. He wanted the new game to be called The Hobby. But in 1947, the British Patent Office was having none of it. They refused to let Peter patent a game as The Hobby because it was too common a name. He went back to the drawing board, licked his wounds, and then returned successfully to patent his game. He went to the Latin for The Hobby, the Latin which simply means smaller than a buzzard. And so Subbutio was born. The head of a hobby has been used as a logo on all Subbutio products and on the crest of Subbutio clubs to this day. A tiny bird, much loved by bird watchers everywhere and for lovers of the beautiful game around the world.
Subbutio. That is brilliant. That's one of the best ones you've done.
You know, I was hugging myself in delight when I came across that. I could not. And I cross-referenced it with three or four times. This can't be right.
This sure.
What a fantastic link.
Oh, Subbutio. Absolutely brilliant. Brilliant. Yeah. We're just about rounding off here, but I'm just going to point out Scotland Outdoors podcast available today at noon. The midweek podcast featuring author Amanda Thompson's available from noon on Wednesday. Okay, so we've got that out the road. But this is the kind of random comment that comes in from our listenership, and it makes this programme an absolute joy. Jill and Ian says, from under the covers, my partner has just said the words, Left Bank 2, in response to your humming of the Tony Hart gallery tune. Apparently, it sounds fine on the ukulele, although they're banned from the bedroom. Well, that's nice to... I can think of no circumstances in which a ukulele would be suitable in the bedroom. But who am I to say? Great programme as always from Jill and Ian. Thank you so much for that. Don't forget, we are going to be live next week at the Edinburgh Festival next Saturday. Still time to get tickets, but from all the team in Aberdeen, thanks for listening.